Okay, so it is wonderful to be joined by, I think, three of the most distinctive, authentic, and brilliant voices that we've had the honor of publishing in Sapir, our fourth issue, which came out earlier this year. It's called Aspiration, the guiding principle to the thematic idea. The guiding principle to the issue was to come up with what we called moonshots for the Jewish people, really ambitious goals that seem, on the one hand, beyond the reach of ordinary philanthropy, ordinary programming. On the other hand, are so important, so essential, that they really need to find the right kind of philanthropic and institutional and intellectual wherewithal to support these ideas, because they're just so extraordinarily essential for a thriving Jewish future, which is what Sapir aims to do and what the Maimonides Fund, which supports Sapir, aims to do. So, without further ado, I'd like to get into your three essays. The reason we have the three of you together, I should say, is Blake's essay, Make Zionism Sexy Again, is about finding a way to bridge the seemingly unbridgeable chasm between the pro-Israel, the Zionist world, and the progressive community in the United States and the West in general. Chloe Vowdery, Enchantment and the Black Jewish Divide, again about building a I don't want to say broken bridge, but an untended bridge between the Black American community and the Jewish American or Ashkenazi Jewish American community. In fact, the Jewish community throughout the world. And Yossi Klein Halevi, about maybe, I would say, maybe even the most ambitious project of all, Muslim-Jewish reconciliation. So the unifying theme here is the Jewish community has these three, if not broken relationships, relationships in need of intense tending. And each of you has written essays offering a kind of a pathway to making that happen. Before I turn to questions, just one final piece of housekeeping. These conversations that we are holding at Sapir are meant to be interactive. They're meant to include our audience, now well north of 200 participants. And so I want at the outset, for those of you who are listening in, when you hear something that piques your curiosity or piques your interest, there's a chat session, there's a Q&A function at the bottom of your screens. Type in your questions, and I promise I will do my very best to get to as many questions as I can. And if it's a specific question for a specific person, make sure to address your question to that person. Let me start, Blake, with you. And I understand you're in Israel right now, is that right? I saw you eating, I thought, bamba or something or other.
Yes, I was eating bamba because the person at the grocery store didn't know how to speak English, so I just pointed to whatever was behind her and I got a bag of bamba out of it.
Okay,
So.
good for you. Blake, you have been a Zionist working, I guess to use the lingo of our day, working in progressive spaces. It was the case up when even when I was young, that to be pro-Israel was in fact the progressive position, or at least it wasn't a position marked by so much of the hostility that you have today. And I think those of us who consider ourselves Zionists, there's a lot of fault finding with what's happened to the progressive movement, and we can talk about that. But you have a deeper critique, which really fascinated me, which is there's some fault here on the Zionist side, and I don't just mean in terms of policy. I mean, your title implies it, make Zionism sexy again. Zionism became unsexy. How did that happen, and how do you start turning it around?
Well, first I want to say, obviously, thank you so much for having me. Very excited to be speaking with Sapir authors. Very excited to write for Sapir originally, and Chloe and Brett and Yossi, your work I've always been a great fan of. So thank you. This piece specifically, Make Zionism Sexy Again, which I realize is kind of a title that throws people off guard. Maybe that was the point. Because the way that I perceive the word Zionism and the way that I perceive the word Zionist, especially going into college without really thinking about these issues before, was a term that was outdated, was a term that wasn't necessary to use in political arguments, in discussions about Israel and discussions about anti-Semitism. Because when I thought of Zionism, I thought of black and white photographs of Israel being established, of very entrenched, established pro-Israel organizations in the United States and around the world that were aligned with a specifically right-wing ideology and a right-wing form of politics in Israel itself. And also in America itself, and the relationship between the Republican Party and Israel. And that's a pretty widespread understanding of that word. And I was really surprised, I guess, to understand that, just as you said, that word, the idea of Zionism, the idea of Jewish self-determination in and of itself, is a radically progressive movement that sought to power, that sought to challenge power structures, to upend systems of social hierarchy, and what we now can consider the most successful indigenous liberation movement of all time. So these are things that are, of course, should be aligned with those who style themselves as freedom fighters, with those who style themselves as speaking truth to authority and in pursuit of shaping a better world. So why wasn't that translating? Why isn't that still happening? And why does Zionism have this bad rap that it does now? And I realize it's because all of the energy and the spirit and the motivation that surrounded Zionism in its early days and that kept Israelis determined to enlist in the army and to keep pursuing this dream of a Jewish state, the other side has sort of appropriated it. They've used very specific strategies and very specific techniques of making their cause, which I believe is anti-progressive, anti-liberal, anti-modern, making it sound progressive and making it sound like something that those who style themselves intersectional activists and advocates who care about the less fortunate should care about. And I think we've let that happen because we've allowed the voice of Zionism to become very polished and very adult and very endowed and kind of wrapped up in this business classist world when it needs to be turned back over to the people who are fighting against anti-Zionism on the front lines of the United States, which tends to be more and more young people.
One of the sources of your inspiration, Blake, is the movement for Soviet Jewry. You write about that in your essay, and some of us are even old enough to remember being involved in it. What does a young progressive like you learn from that movement? What are the takeaways?
Well, for one thing, it was explicitly Jewish, which is why I'm inspired by students supporting Soviet Jewry. It specifically sought to accomplish a goal that was directly tethered to Jewish people and Jewish liberation. It wasn't a sort of universalist progressive movement that just kind of included anti-Semitism or Jewish interests within it. It explicitly had a Jewish goal in mind. And it was of course progressive, and it was liberating for these young people because it was challenging a power structure, challenging an authority, which was the Soviet Union. And it consisted of protesting embassies and protesting politicians, and of course turning out thousands and thousands and thousands of people on the National Mall. And what's interesting is I'm looking back at the last couple years in terms of Jewish activism and in terms of trying to get the Jewish community to care about things. And it seems as though, unless there is a very unless there is a crisis happening in Brooklyn that a lot of people are paying attention to, like during Hanukkah of 2019, it is very hard to get Jews animated about something, to the likes of which we saw on Freedom Sunday all those years ago in the movement for Soviet Jewry. So part of my thinking is, what can we do now to bring back that passion, to bring back that feeling of shared responsibility between Jews here and Jews all over the world? Oh, it needs to be more scrappy. It needs to be led by the young people. It needs to be grassroots. It needs to be directly connecting with Jews all over the country, not just the ones who show up to fancy dinners at AIPAC policy conferences. That's what needs to happen. And SSJ made that happen.
Well, let me ask you, and I'm just going to, this is not directly related to your essay. It's actually a little more related to Chloe's essay, but I want to put the question to Yossi, and Chloe will understand why I'm asking it. You also were active in the movement for Soviet Jewry. There's a fine line, as you famously wrote about, between becoming activist and engaged and militant and angry and destructive. And how does, so I want, Yossi, if you were giving advice to Blake in his activism, how does he keep that activism vibrant and youthful and edgy without becoming, the JDL?
So first of all, Blake and Chloe, I'm just really thrilled to be on this panel with both of you. I'm a big fan of you both. And Brett, I have to say that one of the things that I work hard at is to restrain myself from bothering you and writing you a fan letter after every column.
But you should not restrain yourself, because you're the only one.
But I actually, I'm just exaggerating slightly. So, listening to you, Blake, I first of all, I was, my roots go back to those early years of the Soviet Jewry movement, the mid-60s, before it became a mass movement. And listening to you and hearing echoes of that sensibility, that spirit that animated us in those years, I really feel this deep kinship with what you're trying to do now. And for me, the biggest takeaway of those early years, and I'll try to get to your question, Brett, but I really just want to say this to Blake, is don't listen to people like me, because that's what animated, that's what made the Soviet Jewry movement successful. We didn't listen to those who had the experience of age, those who were able to take a long-term perspective. And I'll give you an example. I've been writing about Israel, defending Israel for many years. And when Amnesty issued its report, my first instinct was, I have to write something. And then I thought, there was the Human Rights Watch report. These things come and go. And that was wrong. And you had the right impulse. This assault is cumulative. And we can't allow any of these assaults to go unanswered. But people like me, who've been doing this for too long, are not really the people you should be looking toward. And in the Soviet Jewry movement, we did not look to the experts. We certainly did not look to Jewish leaders. We felt that saving Soviet Jewry was entirely on the shoulders of about 50 young activists. And we probably weren't wrong, because that was the foundation of the most successful political movement that the diaspora ever launched. And it began with a group of kids who barely had money for a mimeograph machine. And so just trust your intuition. Brett, in terms of your question about, which really relates to your work, Chloe, of how to be passionate and engaged and not cross the line into rage or, God forbid, hatred, And I know that line as well, because I did cross that line. I did go over to the JDL and Mayor Kahana, and I gave into that temptation. In Hebrew, we call it the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. And when I look back at the divide on this, in the Soviet Jewry movement, I think it's very appropriate for today, because there were two camps, there were two approaches among the activists. The first felt that we need to reach out and seek allies in the non-Jewish world. And that was the student struggle for Soviet Jewry that you mentioned, Blake. And the second was Mayor Kahana and the JDL, who believed in that the Jews have no allies. We're completely on our own in a hostile world. And the violence of the JDL was in a way, a natural result of this despair. And so how do you maintain the intensity of activism without crossing the line into what is effect in despair? And that requires a lot of the spiritual work that you, Chloe, talk about in your writing.
So that's a perfect segue, because your essay, Chloe, begins with this really, I think, brilliant meditation and comparison between the JDL and the Nation of Islam. And you really, it's your analysis is essentially psychological, the psychology that went into feeding these two sort of deeply warped, but also deeply felt views of the Black situation in America or the Jewish situation in the world. And you see these rather striking parallels. And you're thinking about this in terms of your life's work, which is the theory of enchantment, which you and I have been talking about, almost since we first met six or seven years ago. So, you know what? Talk a little bit about that, but also talk about in the context of helping Blake, like, or this theme of like creating activism and energy that's based on something other than insecurity and rage.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. And good to be with you all today. So theory of enchantment came out of my desire to really get people to stop hating Israelis. And it came out of my years and years of Israel advocacy, but at the same time, my frustration with the way Israel advocacy was traditionally done. Hasbara, as it's been referred to, is often emphasizing this approach where you sort of memorize the facts about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and then you arrive at an argument, and then you just spew facts at people. And I found that that wasn't sufficient to actually capture the human condition when speaking about Israelis or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it wasn't until I started to read Israeli literature that I got to feel the depth of the humanness of Israeli society with all of its flaws, right? Because being flawed is a part of what it means to be human, which we often forget, but also in regards to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so I started to pivot from how do I get people to be pro-Israel to the question of how do I teach people how to learn to love Israelis, and then to love in general. And I discovered that this question of teaching people how to love has to be, if you wanna have sustained activism, Blake, I think that has to be the core of your approach. Because if you're starting out with how do I teach people how to love, how do I learn how to love, you actually have to learn how to love yourself. And that is very difficult. That's a very difficult practice, because then you have to start to accept the parts of yourself that you don't like. Then you have to start to learn how to get in right relationship with your own insecurities and with your own anxieties so that you don't project them onto others, even when you are protesting their actions or debating their ideological positions. And so to be able to go into a space where you're protesting bad behavior, but still maintaining a love of the person whose behavior you're protesting. That is a deeply difficult thing to do, but it is very possible. And of course, you know, Dr. King in the civil rights movement really advocated for this kind of what he called self-purification in order to be able to do that. It is truly a spiritual endeavor. And that's what we're all about at the Theory of Enchantment, but it takes practice and it takes an ecology of practices to be able to show up every day in that spirit.
You know, one of the aspects of this, of what you're all, the three of you are really talking about are what I think to many of us, maybe many people listening on this call, think of as mission impossible, right? Mm-hmm. The brokenness of the relationship between today's progressive activists, typified by people like AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and the Zionist movement, seems unbridgeable. Even more unbridgeable, the Muslim-Jewish divide. And yet this is work, Yossi, that you have now been engaged in for coming on 10 years. I guess next year will be the 10th anniversary. So tell us a little bit about the genesis of this Muslim leadership initiative that you started with the Shalom Hartman Institute.
Well, first of all, the program brings to our campus in Jerusalem young emerging Muslim American leaders to learn about Judaism, Israel, the conflict at a Zionist institution, which is quite counterintuitive, given that we are very deliberately drawing our students from the mainstream of the Muslim American community. We're not looking for the dissidents, we're not looking for the outliers. And that really is, I think, the strength of the program and the challenge of the program. The program was actually born very much, listening to you, Chloe, I realized it was born in that sensibility. About 20 years ago, I published a book about a journey that I took into Islam and Christianity in the Palestinian, into Palestinian society. And the book came out on September 11th, 2001, which is to say nobody read it. A couple years after the book came out, I got an email from someone I didn't know, a Turkish-born imam, who at the time was the Muslim chaplain at Wesley, and he's now heading Muslim affairs at Duke, Abdullah Antepli. And he said, I read the book, and you know, Brett, you know the writer's joke, oh, you're the one, right? In this case, it was pretty close to the truth. And he said, I was so moved by your love and reverence for Islam that I'd like to take a reciprocal journey into your people's story. And he came to Israel, and we became very close. And Abdullah is the one who initiated this program. He said, I want to confront the growing anti-Semitism in my community and expose young leaders, the future leadership of the Muslim American community, to who you are as a people. I want them to understand your internal narrative. My goal is not to create Muslim Zionists, but to help them understand that when they think of Jews and Judaism as only in a religious context, they are misunderstanding something essential about who the Jewish people is. First of all, that we are a people, and why we're attached to a land, and why national sovereignty is so central to the Jewish experience. And so the program was born precisely out of this act of this strange journey that I took into Islam that nobody knew about, except obviously this one guy for whom this book, I'll say this as a religious person, I believe that this book was meant for Abdullah Antepli. And as a result of my lonely, irrelevant journey into Islam, close to 200 Muslim American leaders have taken a journey into Judaism in Israel.
So the word that I keep coming back to listening to you, Yossi, is enchantment. And Chloe, you know, that's a word you explore in your essay and obviously in the work that you're doing. And enchantment has a connotation of magic, right? Which is why you are fascinated in terms of your own pedagogical tools with teaching Disney movies, where characters have, you know, often have magical qualities, magical talents that they don't even see in themselves until somehow it's presented. And part of magic, as you tell it, is seeing gifts in other people that are hidden from view, something that goes deeper, which is obviously Yossi experienced, and he writes about this in his essay, a certain kind of enchantment in his immersion in Muslim life. There's an enchantment for Blake in discovering the kind of scrappy, truly progressive roots of Zionism. How do you turn people on to enchantment? I guess I'm working my way towards a question, Chloe, I swear, but how do you turn people on to enchantment in this like really reductionist age where we're all being reduced to an identity, a skin color, a very narrow set of personal attributes?
Ironically, I think it's precisely that kind of environment that makes people yearn more for the sensibility of enchantment. It makes people yearn to be able to see themselves and others with the complexity that they contain. Enchantment really refers to this idea or this phenomenon by which we're able to open up to ourselves and to others around us. We say at Theory of Enchantment that there's so much diversity within the single human being, let alone an entire group of people.
So right, you quote Walt Whitman in your essay.
Yes, I contain multitudes. Yes. So if you can give people the tools to be able to see in that way, to be able to start to see in that way, to sort of enhance the quality of their attention. And we know that our attention is being very much vied for by social media platforms, for example, where the quality of our attention is not always necessarily the most enriched quality. But if we could give people the tools to start to see themselves much more deeply, to start to see, for example, the feelings, the emotions that may be behind, let's say, bigotries that other people project, and to be able to respond to the emotions as opposed to the projections themselves, then if we could actually start to do that at scale, then the conversations that we have with each other across divides and across communities that need healing would be far more likely to achieve that healing. One of the things that James Baldwin pointed out is that people are actually super attracted to hatred because they deep down suspect that, like, in order to not deal with hatred or in order to deal with what's beneath hatred, they're going to have to actually deal with pain. And people don't like to admit, or they feel ashamed or embarrassed to admit when they're feeling pain. And so if we could get to a space in our society where we're able to actually express the pains that we're feeling, the traumas that we've experienced, again, the anxieties, the heartbreak, the sorrows, then we can actually see each other in each other's lived experiences, because all of us as human beings have experienced that. And that mutual understanding of our feeling of sorrow is actually necessary for healing to arise.
Blake, building on what Chloe is talking about, you know, my own experience is conversations with young progressives are kind of frustrating, and probably they're as frustrating to them in conversation with me as vice versa. But how do you begin to start the dialogue with a progressive movement in which anti-Zionism has become as much an article of faith as anti-racism? How do you actually start to turn those conversations around? Is it possible, or is it simply a matter of finding a different set of partners and allies to kind of revive Zionism as a thriving youth movement?
Well, I think there is a way to connect progressives with Zionism, but there also is a way to seek other allies. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. It doesn't have to be one or the other. The first thing I will say is to how to try to bring more people into the fold is to not defend Zionism and to not defend Israel. Ruth Weiss once said, if the war against Israel ever needed to be fought on Israeli soil, there would be no more Israel. And so the same thing needs to happen on the college campus. So in the space I'm coming from, especially where I'm dealing with people who I know are already preconditioned to disagree with me, I and the folks over at the New Zionist Congress, we're more zeroed in and attentive to prosecuting anti-Zionism rather than defending Zionism, because we believe that the state of Israel will defend itself. The state of Israel has built an army that will defend its borders. We're fighting the war of the words that is a lot more political and ideological in nature. And I feel like a mistake of the Jewish community has been to highlight all of the things that Israel does correctly, right? Oh, but we have a gay pride celebration in June on the beaches of Tel Aviv. We're a multicultural, pluralistic democracy. There are Arab parties in the Knesset. All of these things that try to make Israel, that are facts, that are true, but they defend Zionism, they defend Israel. But you can't fight an argument that's not using logic with logic. It doesn't work, because they're not interested in what Israel actually is. They're interested in the image of Israel, in the imagination of people who don't like Israel, which has a lot to do with how people have always perceived Jews, right? Not what the Jews are actually doing, not what the Jews actually stand for, but what we represent, what we symbolize in the imagination of people who have heard conspiracy theories about us. We're focused on education and advocacy. And so instead of taking that approach and trying to appeal to progressives, on the ground and using their language and using their rhetoric, just saying, look at the tenets of what anti-Zionism is proposing. It is actually a far right movement that is powered, that is generated by systems of imperialism and colonialism, that was fashioned to appeal to your ears in the Soviet Union, using conspiracy theories that had been existing, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that have been existing for decades prior. One of the most successful videos that the IDF ever put on YouTube was Hamas in their own words during the last operation, Guardian of the Walls, because they took videos of Hamas leaders saying, take a knife and kill all Jews. We want to kill all Jews. And a lot of American progressives, young people, saw that and said, oh, that doesn't sound like Bella Hadid. That doesn't sound like Gigi Hadid. That sounds like a jihadist Islamic movement that seeks to usurp civil rights and civil liberties for people. Maybe there's more to the story. So I'm not interested in, I kind of shy away from the term pro-Israel, because we don't really say that about any other country. Just believing in a country's existence is not really something that we advocate for. We can, of course, agree or disagree with what a country does, but Israel is the only nation that's subjected to that intense double standard or a question of legitimacy. But listen, if that doesn't work, if that particular strategy doesn't work, because as you said, anti-Zionism is so entrenched at this point and it is such a natural opinion to come out of these spaces, then we do have to look for allies in other areas. And those don't necessarily have to be political areas. Brett, you wrote about this, how just reaching people on a human level, reaching people on an imaginative level, by going into different countries, by going into different cultures, different societies, teaching people, like Chloe said, that to see Israelis as human and to love them as human first. That's a really great way to build allies as well, because you're doing something that transcends politics, by being of use to other nations and to other peoples. And, you know, Arab citizens around the Middle East can see that as well when they see that Israel is such a successful country in their midst and that their countries actually are on a path to prosper once they make peace with Israel, once they normalize relations with Israel. Suddenly, all of the preconceived ideas that we have about each other go away because they see it as just an asset to learn more about Israel and to get involved with that people. And so, yeah, I would say try the first one. But if it doesn't work out, we need to stop this like constant trying to reach out to progressives and meet them where they are.
So this is fascinating to me because what you're suggesting, especially the early part of your answer, is how do you get other people to see themselves, right? Including in the more unpleasant, unflattering light. I mean, when you expose someone to the thought that what he thinks is progressive ideology is actually indistinguishable from, you know, right-wing fascistic ideology, there's the possibility of an aha moment. There's also the possibility of an aha moment when another person has the opportunity to understand that his adversary or opponent is a lot more like him than they realize. And so, Yossi, I wanted to pick up on that with you, in that, you know, you have this wonderful scene in your essay in which one of the students at the initiative says, hang on, you're saying that Zionism is not something that happened on account of Western guilt for the Holocaust, but there is a 4,000-year movement an attachment of thousands of years between Jews and the land of Israel, and your friend the imam leans into you and says Dayenu, right? There's that moment of recognition. So is there a technique? What is it that you're doing to create those kinds of aha moments?
So what our approach shares with Blake's approach, which I like very much, is that we don't defend. We're not defensive. What we do is we invite our Muslim students into an internal Jewish conversation. We lay out for them exactly the kinds of struggles, issues that we deal with among ourselves. And, you know, at Hartman, we have groups of American rabbis, American Jewish community leaders who come for seminars, and we treat the Muslim students who come to us as one more internal Hartman group. We don't treat them as outsiders. As soon as you come through the gate, you're part of our internal conversation. And that means that we have conversations with them that are completely lacking self-defensiveness. And we invite our Muslim students to participate in our internal struggles and to try to help them understand the complexity of the issues we're dealing with. And we're not asking for them to support us or oppose us. We're asking them to understand us. That's it. That's the goal of this program. And the responses that we get from participants is that it's a life-changing experience. And it's life-changing because we're opening up the possibility for empathizing, not just with another community that they didn't know, but with a community they thought they knew and didn't like. And so you create these relationships based on opening up your story. And that's really, in general, my approach for dealing with Palestinians in particular, and with the Arab and Muslim world generally. I wrote a book a few years ago, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, which is really based on that same approach. Rather than wait for the next assault against Zionism, and then figuring out how do we push that back, let's take our story to the other side. Let the Arab world or the Muslim world or the Palestinians argue about Zionism rather than for us to be arguing about anti-Zionism. So it's a different approach from yours, Blake, but I would say it's based on the same basic sensibility of a lack of self-consciousness and a great deal of self-confidence in the power of and the charisma of our story.
So we're going to turn to audience questions now. I'll just answer the very first one I see quickly. Alan Kaplan asks who I was speaking about at the beginning. Yossi and I were speaking about our, I just learned now, late friend, Daniel Doron, who just passed away well into his 90s, I think. I knew Daniel when I was editor of the Jerusalem Post, and Daniel was a columnist for the Post, as well as a lifelong advocate for pro-free market measures in the once heavily socialized economy of the state of Israel. So his influence and the benefits of his influence, I think, are visible everywhere in Israel. He had been a graduate student in the United States in the late 1940s when he tried to return to Israel to fight in the War of Independence and wound up as a POW for many months in Lebanon instead. So may his memory be for a blessing. And I'm thinking of his widow, Susan, and his two daughters, now grown daughters. They're very much in my thoughts. Chloe, someone named P.O. Asks, how did your original inclination to advocate for Israel start?
My original inclination started partially the discovery of Leon Uris in high school and some of his novels. But I think more deeply, it began because I grew up as a non-denominational Christian, observing many Jewish holy days. And so the culture that I was immersed in was very much resonant with Jewish culture, which naturally led to a strong aversion to anti-Semitism, which I thought in my naivete was actually a thing of the past. And then in 2012, I discovered that many anti-Semitic occurrences were happening in France in particular. There was a lot of talk about Iran also at that time. And so that's when I got involved as an activist in college to try and do something about it.
So, and how did, just let me add to that, how does Beyonce and Nike shoes add to this general picture? Because I know a little more about
it. So when I started off asking, how do I teach people how to love? I asked myself, well, what are people already in love with? And what can that tell us about the human condition? And so from that question, I started to study massive brands like Disney and Nike and Beyonce, because these brands have religious-like devotion from their followers. And so there's something going on that's interesting with the human condition. And I discovered that all of these brands create content where their audience can see their imperfect, flawed selves and their potential reflected back at them, which is why we gravitate towards them in the first place. And I just want to add something, an aha moment that came up. Part of the reason why it is ineffective for Israel to basically wax poetic about how awesome it is and about how good it is and about how perfect it is because I'm not perfect. And so if I'm trying to connect with you, I need to see your flaws. I actually need to see your imperfections. And then if you are vulnerable enough and transparent enough to show me your imperfections, I will feel moved to do the same. But if you come across to me as this perfect, you know, fixed thing, I will not be able to relate to you as a human being because that is not what I am fundamentally.
Now, a question here is for Blake. Which I now can't find. What does your new Zionist organization offer that J Street, Peace Now, and Partners for Progressive Israel don't already offer? That's from Marion Lipschitz.
Well, first I'll say that the new Zionist Congress does not take an explicit stand on a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The guidelines that we have, we define ourselves as a space for all those who believe in a Jewish and democratic state somewhere between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. Within those guidelines, we are very open. We're focused on conversations. We're focused on debate. We're focused on new ideas within those confines. So that's a way that we differ from these organizations with our, which are explicitly anti-occupation without a lot of substance behind their anti-occupation stances or ideas of what happens after we end the occupation. But in regards to a more broad conversation about what separates us from them, you know, a couple months ago, I took a trip to Brown University to tour Jewish student life there and to report on the stories and experiences of Jewish students who have had to deal with a lot of anti-Semitic scandals over the past couple years, some of them having to do with Israel, some not. And I arrived on a night where this cohort of students was meeting and presenting this beautiful, beautiful project that they had been working on for months. They were releasing a book and they called themselves the Narrow Bridge Project. And this was their book. And the book was a compilation of resources and different perspectives on Zionism, on anti-Zionism, on Israel, on Palestine, on how to have conversations about how to open up, how to see each other eye to eye, and to make campus life more, productive and constructive for people who are interested in this topic. And it was beautiful. You know, it touched all bases. But one of the things that annoyed me about it was that it was all Jews. The application was only extended to Jewish students. And it made me realize how, especially on my experiences on campus and my experience in the Zionist community and the community that is interested about doing something to fight anti-Semitism, is that Jews love nothing more to sit together and to heal the world and to hammer out dialogue and solutions and to disagree with one another and then reach consensus later. While the other side, and I'm speaking about specifically organizations on campus like Students for Justice in Palestine, Jewish Voice for Peace, they boycott all of that work because it normalizes Zionism or gives us a platform, and they just want to say from the river to the sea and not get involved at all. And this is actually a very deep-rooted Jewish compulsion, is to constantly be looking inward to see how we can fix what's happening to us outward. In the face of animosity, what can we change about ourselves? And this is why you will see organizations like J Street don't come out explicitly and condemn a BDS resolution when it's proposed on campus, or a resolution that links Israeli military to American police violence. You won't see organizations like Partners for Progressive Israel and like Peace Now who take a hard stand in not getting into the weeds of if Israel should exist or not. There seems to be an air of more apologia in that sense. And NZC rejects that. We say we're confident that we have a state. We're confident in maintaining that and maintaining its security. And if you are interested in having a dialogue with us on how to reach a more peaceful solution to this conflict, because obviously what we're experiencing right now is unsustainable, we will gladly have that conversation with you. But when there are attacks against what we hold dear and our values as Jewish people, we're not going to mediate or compromise on any of that. And so everybody is welcome into our space, but we draw a very profound marked line in the sand.
This is from an anonymous attendee, and the question's for Yossi. When you speak about the Muslim-Jewish divide, which Muslims are you talking about? The reformists, the moderates, the Islamists, the fundamentalists, politicalists? I'm not sure what politicalist is, but I can guess.
We've drawn from across the spectrum, but most of the participants who come to us are not Islamists on the one hand, and neither are they reformists on the other. When they encounter the complexity of Jewish denominational life, and that's one of the subjects that we lay out for our participants, we routinely get some version of a response of modern orthodoxy. Ah, that's who I am. I'm a modern Orthodox Muslim. So I think that the main slice of MLI participants comes from a denomination in Islam that doesn't formally exist, but it seems to me that there are many candidates for it in American Islam. There's this deep fascination with modern Orthodoxy, precisely because it combines a commitment to the tradition, more or less as it is, with an openness to modernity. So while we have encountered in our groups people who would let's say qualify as Islamist light or reformist light, the majority really come from within the mainstream community, faithful to the normative tradition, and at the same time a little bit restless, looking for something a little more expansive than the constriction of tradition.
Just a quick follow-up, but this is a question from me. Do you think that the Abraham Accords have accelerated that curiosity?
Not in the American Muslim community. The Abraham Accords are extremely unpopular, partly, maybe largely, because Trump was the godfather of the Accords. Maybe because the Accords are perceived to have bypassed the Palestinians. I actually think that in the long term, the Accords are one of the great hopes for creating a regional solution to the Palestinian issue. But that's not the perception of the American Muslim community. As an aside, Brett, I would say that where we're hoping to go in Hartman is move this model of MLI to expand the American project to include the Middle East, to include the countries of the Abraham Accords. And that's very much an outgrowth of what we've learned from the American experience.
A question from Trisha Roth for Chloe. Trisha writes, I run an online support group for Jews dealing with anti-Semitism. Many of us have a lot of anger over anti-Semitism. Maybe I'm asking for a glib answer to a complex question, but can you, there's no other type of answer to complex questions, but glib ones. But can you suggest anything for those of us who are dealing with hurt over anti-Semitism expressed as anger? Being angry can be such an unpleasant place to be. I know that personally, I'd like to move somewhat beyond that.
Yeah, this is a great question. A very simple answer would be to pick up the book Nonviolent Communication by Marshall Rosenberg, which literally contains the answer to that question. And it goes through how to observe your feelings when they arise, identify the need behind the feeling, and then learn how to successfully and with empathy express the feeling so that you can respond in a compassionate way without allowing the anger to control or cloud your judgment. And also, if you aren't in a space to be able to do that, because we're not always in a space to be able to do that, being conscious enough to remove yourself from the situation and say, I'm not feeling enough empathy for myself. I need to feel more empathy for myself in order to engage in this practice. But the book Nonviolent Communication is incredible at answering that question and other questions similar.
Nonviolent Communication, and the author again is?
Marshall Rosenberg.
Marshall Rosenberg. Okay, we'll make a note of that. Peter Eckstein has a question for Blake. He says, Blake, you criticize left liberal pro-Israel Zionist groups for being defensive when it comes to critiques of Israel. You mentioned that you won't compromise on Jewish values. I'm curious, Peter wants to know what those values are and why you think other groups are willing to compromise.
So this actually also goes back to the Brown, the trip that I took where I reported on Jewish life at Brown University. So I first investigated what is not working against the fight against anti-Semitism, in the fight against anti-Semitism. And that was these sort of two introspective self-reflection Bashamnu, Baganu, Divanu happening in the Jewish community in response to the animosity that we face, and defensive arguing and trying to defend Israel and work out the complex things that we're dealing with rather than engage the opponent directly. That wasn't working. But what was working was the steady increase over the last several years in religious students at Brown, in students who looked observant, who participated in Jewish activities like Torah study, like holiday meals, like Shabbat festivities, in pro-Israel rallies, because they were directly recruited from day schools and yeshivas, where there obviously is a strong pro-Israel, the tide is more toward pro-Israelism. And that was a direct, I included a quote from the president of the university, Christina Paxson. That was a direct effort. That was a campaign that was intentional to try to recruit more Jewish students to make campus life more diverse and to give Jewish students a chance to go to an Ivy League school. And from all of the activists that I spoke to, from the people who were involved in this work on campus, that just their mere presence in a lecture hall or walking around the quad, someone wearing a kippah or someone wearing tzitzit, just the mere presence of flyers around campus saying, you know, join us for a Megillah reading, or, you know, what is the Passover Haggadah? Learn about it from Jews who are modern Orthodox, have an observant background. Just their presence did a lot to boost their confidence and to make them feel as if they were empowered on campus. Defensiveness is no part of their MO, right? They came on campus to be Jews, to celebrate Israel and what Israel has to offer, and to celebrate what Jewish theology has to offer and what their traditions and culture, the impact that has on them and the people around them. That was it, right? And what it does is, because if we look more Jewish and we start acting more Jewish, suddenly attacking us seems less progressive. Because one of the reasons why progressives have been attacking Jewish communal life on campus with impunity is because it looks like a white majority group that just has a slightly different religion than the rest of the white majority kids at school. And we are associated with power because of Israel, but also because of deep-seated anti-Semitic ideologies that are running amok in progressive organizations, like our connections with capitalism, our connections with nationalism, and it has a narrative of speaking truth to power. And so if we are visible as a minority with our own particular culture and our own particular way of behaving with one another and celebrating life, then it has a much more noticeable impact in a positive way than trying to defend Israel and work things out constantly in discussion after discussion after discussion. So that's where we come from, a place of Jewish pride above all.
Listen, the questions kept coming, and I'm sad that we're at the end of the hour. We always try to be respectful of people's time, but clearly this conversation has sparked a lot of thought, and that's just being reflected in the volume of questions that we're getting. So Stephen Kurtz, Jeffrey Goldman, Shimon Russo, Gloria Zimmerman, Nathan Lewin, I'm so sorry I wasn't able to get to your questions, but I think this speaks to the kind of the sorts of conversations that we are trying to have through SAPIR, and it's going to continue to develop and expand. So I want to thank the audience for participating in this conversation. We will have future opportunities to do more of this. I really want to thank Blake and Chloe and Yossi for just extraordinary essays. It's in the fourth volume of SAPIR, sapirjournal.org, in the event that you haven't read their superb pieces. Our next issue is going to be about Zionism. I'm excited to wrap up that issue. And I, again, just thank you so much. The nicest thing, though, I think, and Yossi will agree with me, is to see two extraordinarily brilliant, committed, younger people doing this work. who have, a lot of more energy and more time than some of the rest of us do. So thank you for being a part of this chat, and let's do it again. And again, thanks to the audience. You came out. I know it's Monday afternoon. You're great. So as they say, hasta la vista.
Thank you. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you.